G'day, folks. Talk to Jodie Barney, a proud Birriggubba Yeranga woman, the first deaf Aboriginal with a business degree, an Atlantic Fellow for Social Equity, a consultant, community developer, and specialising in advocacy and representation of First Peoples with disability in Australia and abroad. And was an interesting conversation and the dynamics of it too with Jodie and her interpreter. Really appreciate it. Strong messages. Very insightful. Look forward to the next yarn. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. And want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four walls right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast, Jodie.
Yes. I'm very excited, Jake, to be joining with you today.
So let's kick it off with, where's your mob from?
I'm a proud Birriggubba Yerangan woman from Queensland.
You're a long way from home, being down where you are now in Shepparton, hey?
Yeah, I've lived on the country here, the Yorta Yorta and Bangarang people's country for more than 25 years now. And my home is here, but my heart is definitely in Queensland. That's my traditional home, and I visit often, so I don't miss out on being there too much.
Yeah, you're pretty much a local now, and there's a few Briggses down that way, yeah?
Oh, it's a big mob, the Briggs mob. I think they're taking over and spreading profusely. But I've been very fortunate to work and to partner and to be friends with many of the Briggs family members around the traps. Up until now, I've seen new babies. I think there's four babies that have come along recently.
They don't muck around down there.
Yeah, it must be the river water, I think, Jake.
Yeah, and old Briggs on the microphone, the rapper, he does a good job too.
Oh, yes, he does. I don't know him well, but I know his father quite well.
Awesome.
Uncle Paul.
Uncle Paulie Briggs.
There's a lot in here. And, yeah, lots of advertising and advocacy, a lot of work that's being done with the youth here. It's great. They're very, very involved. So we're very fortunate to, I think recently he just got Australian AM, the AM medal, Australian of the Year medal. So, yeah, he's getting the recognition that he deserves.
Yeah, he is a strong advocate for our people. And also, yeah. I want to just jump into, like myself, like I'm a fair-skinned Aboriginal, and like with you, and I just wanted to know, what was it like pretty much growing up in and around Shep as a fair-skinned Aboriginal and also with a disability? And what are some of the barriers that you come up against?
Well, I grew up in Queensland, but then I moved quite a lot. I moved with Dad when he moved for work. I'm one of 12 children. So some have dark skin and some are fair-skinned in my family. So when the community knew, that we didn't really have that much problem, it was accepted. But just broadly, the broader community, I did face barriers. I would be judged and labelled. And so I guess it's pretty difficult for people like us growing up, making a mark in the community and also in the broader community to represent our mob, our very proud to represent our mob, but people thinking or knowing, that, we are actually the first advocates in the world, our mob. So I think what we need to realize, I think for myself anyway, the discrimination that occurs about the color of your skin, and also in my family, because I'm not connected to mob in Victoria, I'm also, I guess, people make judgments when they look at me. And so I had to work pretty hard to show my value. I think I had to be, triply working hard, and I still do that to make sure that we get to the heart of everything culturally, for your identity, for your family, work together collaboratively. I'm an older lady now, and I don't suffer fools kindly. I would prefer to see how things can progress, working collaboratively with the community and with the wider community, using allies. But there's a lot more work to be done, a lot more advocacy to do. We need to raise these issues. We need to inform. We need to improve communication so that we can enhance that communication amongst people.
That's great. And just because I relate to that, just being fair-skinned and myself always having to argue the fact of my Aboriginality. I'm not dark enough. What percentage are you? You don't look like you belong. But when I'm in and around mob know. But it's frustrating from when I was at school, when I've been in work environments, education, just always arguing the fact of that I'm Aboriginal and my identity and having to prove it tirelessly and still.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
And you're a strong advocate, and that's why it's great, seeing and hearing, your voice is pretty loud, and taken seriously, and how it's echoed
Well,
through these guys,
it's been a
like,
lot of work. Been a lot of
yeah,
work to do that.
and it pays off, and it's, when you're translating and it's getting echoed in the way that you want it heard and seen throughout the community, and it's not just from what I've seen personally, it's what I hear in the community from others about the great work that you do, and you should be proud of it when it's got to do with all things First Nations and disability.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe. I think part of our role is really to, as I become older, I think the job, I guess, is to make sure that there's new people in the community who have the skills and capacity and build them up so that we can increase that amongst our mob. What their wishes are, their desires, their goals. What they want to do in life doesn't necessarily have to be a career. It might be studying. It might be that they want to train and learn something. And I've learned and heard over the last few years, especially during COVID and that time online, a lot of fair mob really questioned themselves and they felt quite isolated and didn't know how to work together with other people and how to explain the fact that this is their heritage. That this was not an identity of percentage or color. And this is how I guess we need to think about dealing with identity and disability of various types. Even globally, we can really improve the feeling of belonging in our community. I think part of our, I guess, life and our skills and experience and expertise is being able to teach and train and raise awareness so that we can go ahead and be able to match what is needed, whether it's vulnerable situations that we experience where we feel oppressed and put down, that needs to stop. We need to say that, you're not understanding, and let them know that this is what it means for me and multiple other people. And what you're saying or doing, other people are watching. It's going to affect other people. If you're putting down people in this way by judging them by the way they look, and it's not a good feeling to have. It's certainly not a way of living life. You need to be able to encourage people who are different in whatever way, shape, or form. And if they don't understand it, we have to lead by, I guess, with integrity, and we have to do no harm. And I've heard that there's this common occurrence that people say, I just feel put down. I feel that I'm not worthy. I'm not good enough. That I don't have the expertise. I don't have perhaps a PhD and all of those particular pieces that people want from you. And that's made me roll up my sleeves to work even harder and to do my work, not only in the deaf and hard of hearing space, but in all other disability spaces as well.
Yep. So then if we reel it back, and like when you're talking about goals and study, so if we're going along the lines of where it all started for you in education, what was your experience in having access to Auslan interpreters in general, like over your period of time through school, and then you've gone to uni, like that whole process, how was that for you?
Well, I'd have to say that I didn't have any interpreters in school. That's how old I am now. But if we look at remote Queensland, I got my education at school auditorily, and I can't hear. So I ended up doing my schooling by correspondence. So I would send my work in, I would receive my work by mail, and my father would show me. He taught me how to communicate. And with sign language, he would show me how to do maths in real life situations, how to fix a car, how to measure something. And he taught me how to cook as well. So, and another Aboriginal woman also taught me how to create bush medicine, taught me using sign how to watch the weather patterns, the climate, the clouds, how to prepare for what food was necessary. I was very fortunate to be on country and to be taught those lessons, and people giving me time to actually visually observe what was going on around me so that I could work things out for myself. When I went to mainstream school at the age of 8, I didn't know I was deaf at the time. And the teacher said, oh, she's deaf, because my twin brother, he and I would work together, mob. They're always there side by side. So I would look at his work, and the teacher thought I was cheating, but he was actually showing me what he was doing. And then I said, no, my sister's smarter than me. And then what happened was it made it easier for me because I could observe what was going on around me in the classroom. And then after 2 years, they got in what they call a specialist. And that was when they said, oh, she needs to learn to sign. And at that time, they taught signed English. It was in a special unit within a school with a variety of other disability groups, people with cerebral palsy, blindness, and so on. And I was friends with all of those people, all of those other students, and we could communicate with each other in a variety of ways fine. And I never thought that I was that different, but when I went to mainstream secondary school, then it was, you could, oh, sorry, I've got these fireworks going off in the background. I don't know how that all works, but anyway, sorry, I can't turn it off, Jake. I don't know how that happens, but anyway,
Oh, good.
the stars are out. The stars are aligning anyway. When I went to secondary school in an integrated school, it was very focused on kids who could hear. I mean, I could sign, but it wasn't really valuable for me. Well, I left. I didn't leave really, but I moved on to TAFE, and I qualified as a chef because it was a visual occupation. I could see what was happening in front of me. The routine, the structure of being a chef was easy to follow. I didn't have to worry about talking to people. I'd just focus on tasks, and that was terrific. But then when I went back to university to do further study, I did social work and business studies and community development. That's when interpreters were brought in for me for the very first time in Victoria. Yeah, I never had interpreters in Queensland, but in Victoria, I did get interpreter support, and that was very different because I had to work out turn taking. I had to work out what the role of the interpreter was, how I had to be responsible to make sure we worked as a collaborative team, how to prepare interpreters, because I thought I couldn't just leave them struggling, because if they weren't prepared, then I didn't get the information I needed. If they were well prepared, then that was better for me. I could take things in. So that's how I started collaborating and working with the interpreters. And I started advocating with lecturers, letting them know that the interpreters needed that preparation material, that they needed to work with all of us as a team. And that was important for the lecturer to understand. So I started advocating then. I mean, I've been an advocate for a long, long time, but education is a huge barrier. I've been very fortunate to have gotten the access, and unpacking the importance of communication in education, getting that at the early stages of your education is important. I was very fortunate. My aunt was a speech therapist, and mob, they go off, they don't want to play, they don't want to study, they'll go off and play, and then we'll do it later. So playing sport, being with friends, yarning away, and aunt said to me, I still remember this to this day. She said directly to me, which shocked me, if you don't get an education, Jodie, if you don't get what you should be understanding that's going on around you, then you're going to be labelled deaf and dumb. And I didn't want that. I mean, I'm happy and proud to be deaf, but I didn't want people putting me down and calling me deaf and dumb. So I guess it shows that I am smart, that I can do things, and I don't need to be anything formal or big-headed, or I'm never going to be a brainiac, but I know enough that education needs to start in the home, needs to start early intervention, early educations, whether it be speech, whatever it may be. Aboriginal language, visual language, doesn't matter. It needs to start as early as is possible. Is that
That's fine. The fireworks are going off.
okay?
Yeah, and so you're the first First Nations Aboriginal that's deaf with a hearing impairment with that's gone through university to get a business degree, yeah?
Yes. Yeah. First deaf signing Aboriginal woman to receive a business degree in Australia. Yeah. And at that time, I found out that there were only seven other First Nations people who had university qualifications. Some were teachers, some were social workers or welfare workers or researchers, but not in the business domain.
And with that degree, has it helped out with the advocacy that you're doing today?
Oh, yes. Well, I started my business. I set that up in 2007, my own business, and at that time, I was providing training and I was offering solutions to mob, how they could get access to services, and this was well before the NDIS. And so part of my work was how to show or demonstrate to deaf and hard of hearing mob in the community that they could do any type of job. But managers would be the block. They'd say, oh, No, we can't help you. And so employers wouldn't give them a go. So I thought, right, if I do my social work degree, then I could do my community development degree and then a business degree to understand what is impacting businesses and their bottom line and how we can help mob overcome those negative situations that they're going through. And the negative labels that mob get, it's generational trauma happening over and over again. That welfare mentality, we can show people that they can work. And when I was at university, having that level of communication with CEOs, having that degree, or with government, talking with government, I know what the bottom line is. It's going to improve the situation for our mob. Offer people more opportunities, better opportunities to be successful in life. Get off Centrelink, that mindset of welfare, increase their skills, find their talents, and go for it.
That's it. Opportunities and solutions. So, if you're looking at a lot of mob around the nation and where English is can be third or fourth language, so when you bring in Auslan in the mix, that can be a bit tricky. And has there been ever any development of First Nations sign language in a way, or sort of where it feeds into Auslan, a bit of a hybrid model?
Well, it's not a new area of research at all. They've been looking into it, well, probably since the early or late 1970s. However, linguistically, you're looking at a spoken language, and that's the way they were looking at it, from a spoken language perspective. But when you're talking about sign, it's a visual language. And then they're starting to say, oh, well, it's gesture. And then linguists were starting to write about this. So we know that there are lots of hand talk languages and systems. We've seen some of them. Fully equipped sign language systems. There's not many left now, they've reduced over time. But when you see the impact of colonization and the impact of English, and you see how, I guess, Aboriginal sign languages are culturally bound to the community. They're not something that you can just use like Auslan can be all over the country in any particular place. You see that there's new movement, a new movement at the moment where it's called Black, BLAK, Black signing. And this is where you see the establishment of a bridge, or what you mentioned, a hybrid model where there's no contextual language to explain the different signs. For example, Auslan, there's a sign for country, and this is the sign that I'm using now, C off the head. And cognitively, for our mob, that sign represents authority because it's coming off the head in Auslan. And who's got authority coming off somebody's head? A colonizer. So basically, our sign for country is to represent country, the land. So two hands patting downwards, indicating land, country, my country, your country. So that's the foundation that's bound in the sign. So country visually doesn't necessarily, is not, it's, we've used the country for thousands and thousands of years. Come on, country. Welcome to country. Come sit with me on country. We'll have a yarn. So those signs were used well before white men arrived here. And now we've got a contemporary sign that some First Nations deaf and hard of hearing people are using and approved of. Some haven't, but it can be contentious, but I have to say that there's a lot more work that needs to be done in this space to make sure that there's collaboration between mob so that people will benefit for any contemporary signs or language that's going to be established. Because white people get confused easy enough about Black history. So, you don't want to give them, I guess, another reason to put you down or put our mob down. It's all very new, this space. And I've always said, I need to learn, I need to witness. And I've seen over 200 communities throughout the country. I've had access to different communities all over the place. I'm very fortunate. And that's where I've seen that if you provide people with their cultural language and their cultural sign languages as a foundation and an identity from there, then you can build on it. You can use Auslan as one of those building blocks in the school, or you can introduce it as another language on top. But you have to maintain that cultural sign language and that foundation for those who identify as Aboriginal. You can't switch it. You have to follow what's law, L-O-R-E, what we do and how we communicate with each other. And we have to make sure people understand that.
Yeah, where it all starts, the foundations on country. So, and if they've got someone like yourself, Jody, a part of the BLAK Black movement, being involved in any way, shape, or form, it's going to benefit, and I'll look forward to see where it's going to thrive and grow down the line. And
Well, I have to say that, sorry to interrupt you, Jake, but I do have to say that I'm not really part of that, I guess, Black movement or language group or
get in there.
Black Auslan. I'm not part of it at all. The work that I do and my expertise is cultural sign languages. And how people who use those cultural sign languages still want them, still want to use them and preserve them and record them, and how to use them in different settings. Like, for example, in the health setting, the mental health setting, the justice setting. Whereas the Black movement or Black culture, it's more a metro or city focus, if you like. But there's a lot of mob in that know Auslan, which is absolutely fine, but you can't be fluent in everything. However, the skill that I have or the knowledge that I have is working and talking and researching with community on the ground, supporting people in the justice system that use those language systems.
Well, that's great. Well, I hope whether it's the Black movement, whether it's justice, whether it's any other sector off the back of this or wherever they can find information about yourself, I hope they reach out because they've got to take advantage of expertise that you bring to the table. Very important. And I want to know where some of the inspiration comes from. So whether it's First Nations or just someone in general, Australian, overseas, foreign, just because I've worked alongside you over the years and I've seen your tenacity as an advocate and just where your voice has been echoed through people like Julie and other interpreters, and it's loud and it carries. And where does a lot of that inspiration come from, whether it's family or other people outside of that? Like I said, First Nations, Australian, foreign, where?
Well, I would say simply it's from the community. That's it. Where I can, I offer my skill, my knowledge that's going to benefit a community member to improve their life, to improve their communication, to improve access to their needs. I will advocate for them if they need it. If I need to tell them off, I'll tell them off too. So, I think it's very fortunate that I am following in the footsteps of other leaders. We have very few people in the deaf First Nations space who are older than me, who know the generic community as well. We've got some who have passed away now. Obviously, I can't say their names any longer, but they were interpreters for spoken language services who taught me and mentored me. And they were brilliant. They had knowledge of 10, 12 different sign language structures, which was amazing. And that's how I got a lot of that knowledge. I remember the Royal Commission of Deaths in Custody. And I was a young girl. And I was living in Townsville at the time. And I'm one of the uncles was in prison that I visited. And I was invited to come in. I think I was 14 or 15 at the time. I was very frightened. And they said, "No, mob are going to love you. I love you." So I went in. I didn't know what my role was, but it was to watch and observe this deaf man who was signing. And he was explaining a story about his friend who had passed away. And I thought, "Oh, this is really my first exposure to how, I guess, advocacy and leading with elders and working under their leadership." He was a senior, and I was able to then develop skills. And I'm always reminded that this is their story. This is not my story. It is their stories and their knowledge. And unfortunately, the situation in people's lives is difficult. I'm so privileged to have access to this knowledge that's been passed down to me. I've witnessed a whole lot of stuff. And so I also feel that through the reading that I've done, my father is a Stolen Generation member, and he taught me how to look after mob, how to look after people who have less than you do, don't have as much food, don't have a shirt on their back, don't have a clean shower. So you just give them what you can. That's it. You share and you care for community. And I learned that from a very early age. I also learned confidentiality, that it's very important to be privileged to have those stories shared with you. Some mob don't know what disabilities that they have. They don't know them. They've never heard of the word in English, what disability they have. Or even there's no cultural equivalent, a cultural word that's an equivalent to disability. So how do you then explain to someone that you're going to stay in custody if you can't communicate with the judge? So, that is such a sensitive issue, sensitive topic. But my role is to make sure that the legal team and the legal discussions with psychologists, psychiatrists, and so forth understand that this is important. This is a huge barrier for our mob accessing their communication needs so that we can raise our voices at that level to protect ourselves and also be protecting our communities, our families.
And talking about raising voices, so if you're looking at a lot of the work where you've been in and around the justice sector, and you're looking at the over representation of mob, First Nations, Aboriginal people in jails, male and female, which is very frustrating and disheartening, what you see and hear across the board. So looking at a post that you put out a while ago, and and it's made me think a bit in regards to, when it's got to do with access, whether it's got to do with to interpreters or other means. When you're looking at, there was at that point in time, there was 60 profoundly deaf Aboriginals with a hearing impairment that were in custody, locked up. And I'm just thinking, like, where would it all start for them? Where's their voice when they don't have a voice, when they're trying to get through and get the right interpreters? And like, does the justice system, are they equipped with the knowledge to know who to get and get the resources for their prisoners that have got a disability like this?
Well, I think it's a huge issue, Jake. The justice system or the prison system have their own ways in terms of what will be offered and accessible. Often it's close the door and that's it. Many people I know that work in the prison system have tried, but the system itself, the policies, government decision making, it's just not taken seriously. There's no training of people working in those systems. We know that mob that are in custody, it could be up to 97%, maybe 94% of them have a hearing loss of some description. And if the prison audio systems are not working, how are they going to know what's going on in the prison? If they might repair the audio system, maybe that they would improve in terms of less frustration when they're in prison. There's a lot of solutions, there's a lot of problems, but a lot of people need to, you know, what they do is they just look at a checklist and tick things off. They're not seeing the whole human person. They're really not realizing what access means. There was one guy who was deaf who had cerebral palsy as well, and he had his very first wheelchair, I think at 22 or 20, in his 20s. He's now 60 and he still has the same wheelchair that he got in his 20s, and he's in custody. The reason being is that family's saying that if we give this prison a new wheelchair for him, it's going to get damaged, and we want a new one for when he's released, because the NDIS won't provide a new wheelchair after he's released. So the family won't give him a new wheelchair, so he has to use his old one, which I think is probably about 30 years old, while he's in custody. I mean, how's that equitable? How's that a human right to have access to something like that?
That's disgusting.
Yeah, and that's the system. But I do think that now, this gentleman was left out of the whole court process. The family were the ones that videoed in, and, you know, with court, you can do online video court, but he actually never entered the courthouse at all because of his physical disability, because there was no way to transfer him from the prison to the courthouse. No accessible van. And so they said, oh, no, he can watch it. You can watch it online. But the problem there is, you know, mob, especially if somebody has cerebral palsy, might not have total muscle control of his head. He needs to be able to see what's going on, and a screen can be very small. He needs to also see the environment and see who's in that environment. And he needs to know that his family is there so that they can provide him with support. And that's where you see a lot of the barriers as well, in the courthouse. That's just an example, that one story.
I know, and that's one of many, which is very unfortunate. So this is a focus section, or I should say this is a focus sector for you, yeah, when it comes to advocacy. So when it comes to whether it's First Nations in Australia or outside of that, because you've been involved in some international stuff, have you, when it's got to do with any other First Nations groups around in other countries, or it's drawing upon what happens in other nations, and if it's bringing back any information back here that's going to help assist you and assist mob in general in the community?
Yes. Yes, that's right. What I am is an Atlantic Fellow for Social Equity. So my involvement is with the Atlantic Fellowship program globally. There's 7 hubs globally. And I worked with a number of people for various reasons. And we raised what the equity issues are. And we were challenged with each other, First Nations people. You know, the challenges are rural, remote people, communication, language preservation, and so on. And so I was given opportunities to visit various countries around and mobs around to see what the solutions are. And I've looked internationally at the profile of First Nations people and what we can glean from what they know to then establish more discussions for what we can do here for our mob. And recently, I got a Churchill Fellowship. And so my Churchill Fellowship, thank you, Jake. My Churchill Fellowship is focusing on First Nations people who are deaf, who are in custody, and use their own cultural sign languages, and what the benefits and needs are in terms of the support that they get for what's happening here in Australia. What do we need to do? How do we change legislation? How do we improve access for those who are in custody here and improve the interpreter service so we can increase the numbers of skilled interpreters when they're working with First Nations people? So I guess what the benefits are for our mob, what the risks are, and I'm going to be visiting several countries to talk with a number of First Nations people about their sign language systems and how the justice system or services are providing services to these people when they're young and post-release, right through the whole gamut. So for me, I'm going to glean information. It's going to take me 10 weeks. I'm going overseas and hopefully find out, I guess, by asking the question or questions of our government to think about what needs to be done. But before I do that, I'm going to write up that information and share it with the community and work with First Nations interpreters and those that are deaf and hard of hearing and spoken language interpreters and deaf and hard of hearing mob who work in this space so that we can get their feedback as well and make sure that we have that holistic approach to the research so that we can solve these problems and reduce the numbers of deaf and hard of hearing people who are in custody.
That's great. So, and if you look at where you're looking at the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, which works in and around, the justice system, the justice sector, when it works around all types of different disabilities, whether it's physical, invisible. So, does the scheme work for you? And what do you think of the scheme in its current state?
Oh, what a loaded question, Jake. Thanks for that.
It's probably a whole nother podcast.
I think it is, but I have to say that my NDIS plan, the one that I have for myself individually, is great. It works for me. I still need to make sure that I guess that I'm a little trip. I guess I have some trepidation about how I can use my plan, but for right now, it's giving me more access to information with the provision of interpreter support that I need for my everyday life. And I guess in my professional life, the NDIS has two things that it's provided for me, and I'll share those with you. I'm here in Victoria, and I'm currently a member of the NDIS Community Advisory Committee. Just recently, I was appointed to that. And so I'm very excited to be involved and have a voice at the table at that level. And I'm sure that I'm going to be doing the best I can to make that heard. And the other thing was, I received a grant 2 years ago to establish an online free training course for rural and remote communities, people who work as support workers and working with First Nations deaf or hard of hearing people. So that funding was from the NDIA, their Quality and Safeguards Commission. And it's an e-learning program, and we hope that it's going to be launched in April, fingers crossed. And I have to finish off my part by the end of March. And this is going to be a free online training course for support workers and support coordinators and guardians, people who are involved doing NDIS work with participants, who are deaf and hard of hearing in rural and remote regions. So First Nations people are involved, so they're very, very, very excited about it. It's been a lot of hard work. A lot of consultations have taken place, a lot of interviews. We've received a lot of feedback, and we've gone through ethics committees and First Nations deaf and hard of hearing people and organisations. So it's been a huge responsibility. However, what I've found for myself is that it's a bit of a legacy piece of the work that I've done. Certainly not all of the work I've done. It's a small piece, but it's a start. And you have to start somewhere for people to start to learn what the appropriate way of working as allies with deaf and hard of hearing. I've worked with the University of Melbourne, with other professionals, and I've worked with those people who have, I guess, the same interest, keen interest, to make sure that we provide people in rural communities with, and, you know, remote communities with access. And that includes, I guess, remote individuals who have also been brought to the cities for whatever reason as well.
That's great. And last question, I know you got to go, but just, and you can keep this one short because I know you got to cruise. So if you're looking at yourself being appointed a part of the First People Strategic Advisory Group, when it's got to do about the Disability Royal Commission, and I was a part of that too, and it was a great experience, but more importantly, the collective stories from around the nation getting built up as a driving force to make effective change to disability across the nation. So do you think off the back of those couple of years, and when you're looking at the recommendations, do you think that it is going to make effective change?
I guess I'm a half full glass girl. I think, yeah, I think it needs more work. I think it needs a lot more talk. I think it needs a lot more cultural overlay. We need to increase capacity of people to work with us to make sure that our voices are at the table from the beginning. And I find that what we often see is that we don't know that change has happened until it's too late. And I'm hopeful that we will have that voice at the table at the outset. And you know what? I think, you know, I want us to be leading the table. So I think we need to make sure that our voices are diverse and not confused with other issues. Just because we're disability folk, we need to be able to celebrate who we are without being labelled with all these other things. We need to make sure that our voice is heard. And my motto is, or my tagline for my business is, give the community a voice, make it happen. And that means that we have to sometimes let the community do the work and come back and support them if we're invited. And if not, we can do something in the background and offer information, offer opportunities where we can. We need to make sure that it's transactional. We want new blood. We're in a new generation, us oldies, being seen over and over again. We need to have that refreshing new mob coming in and making sure that they're not isolated. And elders need to have that time to rest. They've done brilliant work making sure we support our elders. You know, the elders have been working more than they ever have. So I think we need to make sure that we're sharing those responsibilities and sharing the load, and offer young people of the future of our 65,000 years of lived experience that pathway into the future, offering our knowledge for them.
Yeah, that's right. And like you said it, Jody, it's that cultural overlay. We're all a part of this nation's fabric. So we should be along for the journey, you know, at different levels, community, state, federal, getting the voices out there, whether it's our own voice or getting it out there through others. As long as we're heard, that's all that matters, and hopefully make an effective change. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast today. I was very excited for this, and I'll look forward to having another yarn with you down the line, that's for sure.
Anytime, Jake, anytime. Maybe when I get back from overseas, I'll let you know how things went with other First Nations mob around the world.
Great. Look forward to it.
Great. Thanks again, Jake.
Yeah, that was a cool yarn. It's great. Just the dynamics of it. When you've got Auslan interpretation and just the flow of the conversation and just the powerful words that Jody's putting out through her fingertips. Solid. Loved it. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at streetrollingcheetah or email, one word, streetrollingcheetah@gmail.com. We've got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. You can get me on LinkedIn, just Jake Briggs. I want to thank our sponsors. Permaville Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four walls right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.